The Bigger Picture. Going behind the headlines of the biggest economic and political stories of the day.
Nothing is really impossible if you put your mind to it. After all, as I once said, I was the future once.
Joining me to discuss the political stories of the moment is Mike Indian, political commentator, author of the blog The Groucho Tendency. Mike, welcome back.
Hello, Simon.
Our last conversation, of course, was looking at the extraordinary aftermath of the election. And now, of course, politics is now all smooth. Everything is plain sailing. We're going to talk first, though, about the public sector pay cap, because apart from anything else, the government doesn't appear to be speaking with one voice on this. First of all, let's just recap and ask what this cap actually is.
So since 2010, since George Osborne was Chancellor, he imposed a limit of 1% pay cap across all public sector pay bodies. They were free to basically promote rises up to that level within that. So the actual rises themselves are still set by the body for doctors, the body for firefighters, the body for police officers. But they had to stick within a 1% cap as well. And this was designed at the height of the aftermath of the financial crisis, the advent of austerity, to show that those in the public sector were doing their bit to help keep the costs of the country down and to help reduce the deficit. Mm. We're 7 years later now, and of course we're in a very different time of personalities, climate and policies, Simon.
Yes. Yes. Now, those in the public sector, of course, in theory, their wages are free to rise, but of course they haven't been doing that. But public sector workers clearly are irritated that this cap is still there. So where did the hint that the cap might be about to disappear come from first?
It slipped out very, very quietly. First of all, in a suggestion, I think it began at the start of the week with Michael Gove raising the possibility as well. Boris Johnson has now briefed the press through his various means that he would support raising the cap too. And we were left with a rather bizarre spectacle. Because don't forget, Theresa May spent a good chunk of the time since last July trying to distance herself from the mantra of the Cameron-Osborne era. Mm. The public sector pay cap is a totemic Osborneite policy. She spent PMQs of this week basically insisting that the cap had to remain. Now, there's only one cabinet minister who's been advocating that position, and that's, of course, Mr. Finance himself, Philip Hammond, the man who she was rumoured to be wanting to sack had she won that increased majority. It really shows how funny things come around sometimes in politics.
And so Johnson, we understand, said that it was going to be OK to raise the cap. But then on the Today programme, apparently said no, agreed and the need to take a fiscally sensible and responsible approach. So what we're getting here is some degree of confusion, even among bits of the government that you think ought to be able to agree with each other. I mean, is this indicative of the fact that Theresa May just does not have a grip on her party, or is it just a shambles?
I think it's an indication of how tight the grip was before, particularly under Nick Timothy and Fiona Hill. There's stories that Fiona Hill would text dissenting cabinet ministers or verbally overrule them in meetings.
And these are the two very close advisers who then resigned.
Yes.
Of their own volition after the election.
Absolutely. And it's left, really, this is the different climate in which the government operates now. Now, of course, Theresa May ran a very dictatorial approach in the first 11 or so months inside number 10. She then had to be faced with this possibility now of having to work with a more consensual cabinet approach. But under the approach that previously operated, cabinet ministers couldn't voice any dissenting opinion at all. Now, maybe if she had started off as she intended, she had a more convivial attitude behind the scenes and around the cabinet table, we wouldn't have this situation. But it's just a sign this week. In fact, nothing summed up this better than the story of the Times earlier this week, which showed that Andrea Leadsom, upon hearing she wouldn't get her desired promotion to Home Secretary or, heaven forbid, Foreign Secretary, wanted a high-profile role. Miss May gave it to her. Someone, again, she wanted to get rid of. The Prime Minister's authority has drained away since the election. She's virtually invisible now in the news cycle. And it's up to her cabinet ministers now to try and portray some semblance of discipline, whilst at the same time trying to pander to some element of populism that Jeremy Corbyn has clearly swept up with his election victory.
Yes, discipline is not what we often get from the Conservatives, and this is certainly not the time when we're getting even the impression of it. It's not only the public sector pay cap. Of course, Brexit, the other issue that often it'll divide Labour as well, but it certainly has caused problems for the Conservatives in the past. And there's increasing disagreement, it would seem, between number 10 and number 11 Downing Street. So is Hammond then sort of becoming the sort of front man for the sort of not quite Remainers, but let's say as close to remaining as we can be while still saying Brexit?
I think that Hammond is the champion for a softer Brexit, really. I mean, you don't become Chancellor without inheriting a good degree of Treasury mantra. And of course, that is based on securing a smoother possible transition to as fine a possible trade agreement with the European Union, which basically means as low as possible tariffs, minimal possible regulatory disruption, and ensuring that living standards don't dip as a result of leaving the European Union. Now, growth forecasts have already slowed. Inflation is rising. The Bank of England is talking about raising interest rates for the first time in 10 years, although this probably won't come till later the year if we believe the chief economist. Philip Hammond, however, is Theresa May's shield at the moment. He is a good friend of hers, or at least a good acquaintance. He is a man who has continually voiced reason, but is someone whose voice has been suppressed until now. You can't help but feel that Ms May might have actually benefited from being a little more open with her Chancellor, bringing him on side more and not forcing him to make that humiliating U-turn on NIC, on national insurance contributions, back in March.
Just how long ago that budget now seems. So much water under the bridge. So we're not going to see a sort of big rift, you think, between number 10 and number 11, as perhaps we did under the Blair.
I think Philip Hammond will be the man who eventually convinces Theresa May that it's time to stand down. But for the moment, she is the one who's walking in lockstep with him. And let's be clear here, he's the one who's finally calling the shots now. The Economist ran a very flattering column on him in Badgett a couple of weeks ago, saying that he was the only adult left in the room, really. The only responsible one left in government. Not an exciting man, but advocating him as a technocratic caretaker to take over from Ms May.
Not an exciting man, might be putting it mildly. Absolutely. I mean, even he makes jokes about how dull he is.
But that, I think, at the moment is really the kind of parliament we operate in at the moment. The Conservatives want a boring, smooth Brexit process. David Davis has been far more conciliatory in his tone with Michel Barnier, although the remarks about how French he is and in interviews with Andrew Marr are probably not necessarily the best way to go about proceeding with this.
And what about Boris? I mean, sidelined almost completely in the election. He was incredibly quiet. We've heard almost nothing from him except this rumoured sort of discussion about the pay cap, which then sort of got retracted again. So how do they keep Boris quiet? You would think that would be quite difficult.
I don't think they can really count on Boris keeping his head down for much longer here. He has a very important but largely peripheral role in Foreign Secretary, I think, because don't forget the key diplomatic connections here in terms of Brexit are still conducted by David Davis and the Department for Exiting the European Union. But Boris Johnson is the king over the water for many people here. His supporters, he never really got to run for the Conservative leadership last year. Now, Michael Gove and he lining up here perhaps suggested that old Gove-Johnson axis that could have been so potent had they worked together last year. And I suggest if he and Johnson had stuck together, they probably might have won that leadership election against Theresa May, being the far more appealing option to the Conservative grassroots. Because don't forget, Theresa May's appeal among her own party members has plummeted now. A survey for Conservative Home this week put David Davis at the top of the list, the man who 12 years ago lost the leadership contest to David Cameron. So what we're really seeing here is that kind of jostling for position to run for the leadership in a couple of years' time. But I don't think the Prime Minister's shelf life is really going to extend that far. The leadership contest will come far sooner than that. It'll be far more brutal and it will probably cost the Conservatives power as a result.
So when Boris Johnson says that Theresa May has shown unbelievable grace and steel and that the PM had put things back together and got the show back on the road and dismisses any talk of leadership speculation, all he's really doing is just under his breath saying, yeah, for the next week or so.
That reads like a eulogy to me. I don't know about you. Boris Johnson is itching to run to be Prime Minister here, and his sort of bouncy populist stance on Brexit would indeed be what many people worry is from the Remain side would invigorate the Tory Eurosceptics. But also don't forget there are those Brexiteers within government who are reportedly concerned about the integrity of the process at all now. We are 3 months into this. We have made next to no progress. Formal talks are finally underway between Michel Barnier and David Davis here. But all the talk's going to be, it's going to be thin gruel for the Brexiteers so far until we settle the issue of the exit bill. And even then, there's a possibility of a snap election and a change of Prime Minister, or at the very least, before the 2019 is done. If the government's going to last the course, if the Conservative Party's going to last the course, the Cabinet has to rally around Theresa May, be far more disciplined and give her the breathing room to get this job done. At the moment, though, they're enjoying their freedom far too much.
Okay, Mike, we'll be back in a moment.
Sharing ideas about money. This is Share Radio.
You're listening to The Bigger Picture on Share Radio. I'm with Mike Indian, political commentator, author of the blog The Grouch Show, Tendency. I didn't think I would be saying this again, but we need to look back at the Chilcot inquiry, the outcome of which came out just after the referendum, when people didn't seem as excited by it as they had been perhaps in the run-up to it. It sort of somehow got forgotten, doesn't it? But to John Chilcot, who's the author of the 2 million word inquiry, which took 7 years to complete, has actually given an interview to the BBC. And, well, what he's had to say is actually rather more interesting, perhaps, than people consider the report itself.
Absolutely. He hasn't done what many people expected him to do, which is to sit down, shut up and just get out of the way. Think about how Lord Leveson behaved in the aftermath of his inquiry into press standards, and the second part of that's still to come, of course. Sir John's report really didn't get the airing it perhaps needed as well, or perhaps many in the Labour Party on Jeremy Corbyn's camp would have wanted it to have done. But he's come out, given this interview to the BBC's Laura Kunzberg, in which he has said that he believes that Mr Blair gave his inquiry emotionally truthful evidence, but not necessarily based in fact, which seems to sum up how many people believed, at the very least, Tony Blair operated here.
Yes.
And we could talk about the shadow of Iraq and being a generational issue here. I was at an event with Jeremy Corbyn on the day we were recording this morning, and a journalist from the Daily Mirror asked him, "What's your reaction to this?" Well, it seemed to me to be an incredibly stupid question to ask Jeremy Corbyn, because we know where Jeremy Corbyn stands on the Iraq inquiry. There are far bigger questions to ask Jeremy Corbyn than what he thinks about Tony Blair's stance on Iraq. But as a society, we are still getting over this. Now, of course, for people who are younger than myself, perhaps sort of the millennial generation, who have flocked to vote for Labour in droves, this is a shadow in the background that confirms really how big and bad Labour's recent past was as well. But I think what this interview is symptomatic of is perhaps the desire for Sir John to remind us of this highly significant event in our recent political history, because Brexit threatens to overshadow all, but we mustn't forget that Iraq was one of those events that really did undermine trust in a very popular prime minister here as well. And we can talk about what really saps the energy of leaders in the moment, and it's events like Iraq that suck all the oxygen out of the room. I mean, if you read Alistair Campbell's diaries from sort of 2003, you can really see at that point, before Iraq really gets going, how much energy Tony Blair has in those last 4 years. If you think about that third term and that wasted energy as well. But I think it offers a lesson too for politicians on how to handle crisis today. I mean, for Theresa May, she's had to commit to a public inquiry on the Grenfell Tower disaster, for example, as well. What we really need to draw a lesson from the Iraq inquiry is here too. You read the words emotionally truthful, it almost can be in parallel in my mind with the modern label of fake news as well. This idea that politicians still have more appeal to people on an emotional level than facts do as well. And it could arguably draw that parallel out to an extreme level with the populism that we saw underwriting the way that brought Brexit and Donald Trump to power.
But if Sir John Chilcot is now saying, essentially, you know, this is almost the same as Clinton, you know, it wasn't really sex, but it wasn't really a lie. But why did the report itself not say it? Why is he now having to interpret his own report? Now, there are 2 million words in there. Surely what he's saying now is terribly important. Why wasn't it in the report?
I think it's one of these cases where you are handed effectively an unexploded bomb in the form of the reaction. Because the Iraq inquiry, I think, lasted through three different prime ministers. Gordon Brown had set it up. Most of it was conducted under David Cameron, who sent irritable letters to Sir John about it. And it came out just at the start of Theresa May's premiership. And it all concerns a man who was in Downing Street, left Downing Street now 10 years ago. But it still casts this incredible shadow. I mean, it's impossible to explain in detail just how much significant this is in terms of how much it damaged trust in the political classes as well. Because the distrust in authority has been growing in British politics for the last 50 years or so. But I think Iraq really accelerated that as well. Because Tony Blair famously said, people believe I'm a pretty straight kind of guy. But actually, in the end, it doesn't matter if people act with conviction. If you undertake an action that most people end up then believing to be morally wrong in hindsight, and of course it's given, it's probably the biggest boon, it's given Jeremy Corbyn this opportunity to present himself as a break with Labour's recent past as well, whereas many people see Jeremy Corbyn's views as that of a dinosaur. For most people, this is the old Labour now. The Blair government is the old Labour. It is that association with spin, with sleaze, with the sexed up dossier. I mean, one thing that I've always admired Tony Benn and Alistair Campbell for is that they have never shied away from answering questions about this as well, though. And we must remember that last year, when this report came out, Tony Benn held a 2-hour press conference and he took every single journalist question on this issue. Alistair Campbell never shies away from debating with people like Owen Jones, who are on the further to the left than he is. And you look at how minimal the media contact is now between the two most senior politicians in this country in the most recent election campaign, Theresa May and Jeremy Corbyn. You can't but think they could learn a lesson or two from the masters of the dark arts, perhaps.
Because what you were saying is the leader of the Labour Party and the leader of the Conservative Party want to try and have as little to do with the press as possible.
Yes, and I think, you know, whatever you can think about the Iraq's inquiry, you are in no doubt over where Mr Blair stands on it. He has basically aired most of the questions here. And what it's enabled it to do this year, when something in empty lights comes up again and Sir John's sitting there answering questions, is that his spokesperson can simply say, oh, we've answered all questions about this. You can't help but feel if Theresa May had adopted a similar strategy after her disastrous dementia tax U-turn, in which he insisted nothing had changed, if media management in this for both parties was better, they'd simply be getting on better in terms of their political fortunes right now, especially the Conservatives.
I was interested when Sir John talked about the note sent by Tony Blair to George Bush in 2002, which said, I shall be with you whatever. And Chilcot said, well, why did he say that? You're giving away too much. You're making a binding commitment by one sovereign government to another, which you can't fulfil. You're not in a position to fulfil it. I mean, he didn't even know the legal position at that point. It seems almost foolhardy.
The relationship between Tony Blair and George W. Bush has been picked over, examined, and of course, in its most infamous, we were portrayed as being America's poodle here. What I think is more nuanced here is it portrays Blair's belief, because don't forget, if you remember his Chicago speech, here was a man who believed firmly in the doctrine of liberal interventionism and believed that countries had a moral imperative to stand and intervene if you believed something was wrong. Now, of course, he tried to operate as far as possible within the institutes of the international liberal order that was set up after the Second World War. We've seen it go the other way now here. You know, the UK has, since 2003, become more inward-looking. Brexit is the best example of that, I think. You know, we're now more distrustful of migrants in this country. And then and America's just elected a president whose own mantra is America first and who doesn't like taking foreign trips. We've moved a long way from that now. You couldn't imagine such a note of understanding going between Donald Trump or Theresa May, no matter how much hand-holding has been conducted in the White House now. So you've got to look at the merits on both sides now as well. The three pillars of our foreign policy have been America, the European Union, and the emerging world for the last 50 years now. Our relationship with America has soured since Barack Obama because he realised that his interests had to pivot to Asia. We're pulling up the drawbridge from Europe as well, and the emerging world doesn't want to know us. So we really have to perhaps lament a time when we could actually convince an American president now as well. There's a certain amount of diplomatic clout there that this country is really lacking these days, Simon.
Well, let's just think for a moment then about the inquiry. It took 7 years. It was 2 million words long. The latest inquiry is going to be that into the awful fire at the Grenfell Tower, in which we know at least 80 people, probably more, died. That was 3 weeks ago. And now, of course, there's already a fuss now about the inquiry, about whether Sir Martin Moore-Bick is the right person. Presumably there's going to be a balance between giving as many people their views and also trying to make sure it's not going to take another 7 years. Admittedly, perhaps Iraq is more complicated. But how do we get the balance right? And how do we make sure the right person is in charge of the inquiry? We saw the awful thing with the sort of the child abuse, where it almost became a farce, where they kept replacing the head of the inquiry. So how does the government get the balance right between making sure the right person is at the head of the inquiry while also satisfying the residence groups that seem to think that he may not be the right person?
I think the recent lesson from public inquiries, particularly with the historic allegations of child abuse, is that the public inquiry vehicle is not enough to satisfy most people here. I mean, I think we saw in the case of Hillsborough an example of a public inquiry conducted well, but more often than that, the government lacks a sufficient form of redress to help the victims of these terrible, terrible tragedies. I mean, they're already calling for an inquiry this week. I think it is Diana Johnson in House of Commons who wanted to see one into contaminated blood. The simple fact is that the government cannot have multiple public inquiries running at the same time, and we need a better system of redress for happening in the way. And for the fact to get to this point here, I really suggest how much empathy people really feel they need from their political leaders as well. And I think the best example of what can be done is simply showing a small degree of understanding here. I mean, Theresa May's visit to the Grenfell site was universally judged to be an error now, where she went down and didn't speak to any resident. Jeremy Corbyn photographed hugging a resident. There are very few politicians today who really have an empathy and understanding of what it's like to be among the poorest people in our society as well. We often spoke about David Cameron's empathy in terms of using the NHS as well. Part of Jeremy Corbyn's appeal is that people actually believe he understands and cares about their way of life. Now, Theresa May isn't, as I believe, as equipped to present herself in that way, but she could have gone down there and met with residents. So what we really need here, and I don't know if there's a perfect example here, is to really look at the kind of people we're returning to office here. And I'm not just talking about Downing Street and the House of Commons. I'm talking about going into our councils, who are going in to run the police and crime commissioners, who go to run the quangos and other public service bodies that deliver the services on which we all depend, the housing officers. We really need a wholesale look at who is going to run our public services, because I believe that a lack of democratic engagement over the last 30, 40 years has really stymied that number of people, restricted it probably to mostly white people of a well-off background as well. Certainly if you judge it by the number of MPs, we still have, you know, equal numbers of female MPs in the House of Commons. And the result is the perspective on policy making, the input from the public and those people interpreting those results is now incredibly limited. And that is how we get to situations like this.
So of course, as you know, that I mean, from politics, whether it be in central government or local government, there are certain sorts of people who want to do that sort of role. And quite often, I'm sure you see so many of them, quite often you could say the sort of person that wants to do that job is exactly the wrong person to be doing it. But the problem is you can't force people to actually participate in local government life. How can you change it? Even if you're aware that there's a problem, that we need to get different people into these sort of positions, how on earth can that be done? How do we encourage it without really scrapping the system and starting all over again?
I think we need to take a lesson from tragedies like Grenfell and realise that actually the old adage of for evil to happen, good people simply have to do nothing. Now, of course, I'm not saying that this could have been prevented by more people turning up and voting at local elections as well. But it seems, certainly from the signs of the 190-odd building tests that have failed so far, and from
every single one that's been tried so far,
that we have been running our public services most recently on the basis of cost. And we've forgotten the human element of our public services as well. And that applies to the public sector pay cap. It applies to people, nurses having to use food banks that Jeremy Corbyn talks about as well. There used to be in Britain a strong tradition of public service that people talk about as well. And I still believe people have that. I still have a great deal of admiration for those people who do stand to become MPs, who do become councillors. They have a reputation sometimes of being a limited class, but they do put themselves out there. It is not a profession that has a great deal of glamour associated with in the public eye. So I don't really know if there's a simple answer to it, Simon, but I would say to people who are angry about Grenfell Tower and wanting to make a change in the system, the best way to do that is to turn up, make sure, you know, not just protest, but actually get involved, be elected to your local council, serve on these bodies and make sure that your perspective is heard.
That's a long-term thing. What about the inquiry itself? Well, clearly, we don't want an inquiry in which many of the people who've actually got a stake in the outcome are going to be unhappy right from the word go, do we?
No, but I think also at some point they have to have some faith in the amount of redress that has been offered to them as well. But I think also parliamentary select committees can offer a recourse for this as well. There are other methods that not just through the press but through parliament, through the court of public opinion, who can also perhaps offer some form of redress for them too. The public accounts committee can perhaps assess how much has been spent, for example, on housing, and some immediate reforms by the government too. A new housing act to immediately bolster fire safety regulations, publication report, full transparency. If a mistake has been made, airing it in the light of day without the pressure of the press or anything being repressed found out will help restore faith in our democratic institutions. And that's the very best we can hope for from this horrible, horrible event, I think.
Mike, thank you very much. Much food for thought there. That's Mike Indian, political commentator, author of the blog The Groucho Tendency.
The bigger picture, going behind the headlines of the biggest economic and political stories of the day.